The question everyone seems to be asking, what's going on with all those balloons? Our guest believes the answer isn't just up in the air.
It's not just about balloons. This is part of an industrial-scale espionage undertaking that China has been doing for years now.
Also today, the U.S. military seems pretty sure that China plans to attack Taiwan, but some China experts disagree.
I think this is just completely off base.
Plus, you think you need more space? In Tokyo, people are making do with apartments less than 100 square feet. This woman says she's gotten used to it, but she still bumps into things all the time. I'm Marco Werman. That's all ahead today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us. We begin today way up in the stratosphere, and this question, what is up with all these balloons? The U.S. has shot down four flying objects in recent weeks. At least one was a Chinese balloon, and now China is accusing Washington of its own balloon espionage program, one that's allegedly sending high-altitude balloons over western China and Tibet. The Biden administration denies the claim. This tit-for-tat is being watched closely by military balloon experts like my next guest. Tom Carrico is senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Tom, where do balloons fit into a larger military strategy?
I think this is a bit of a wake-up call for a lot of folks. Balloons, technology has been around for a very long time. It's a pretty useful platform for a heavy payload to do just tons and tons of different missions. Including, by the way, some pretty sophisticated surveillance, which presumably this first Chinese balloon was undertaking over American ICBM fields. Lighter-than-air aircraft in the coming years, whether it be for surveillance, whether it be for air and missile threat tracking and detection, you're going to see more of this. There's also, frankly, just some utility here in terms of the public perception waking up to a range of Chinese activities.
And that's because you believe there will be more balloons sent into the sky, or just because we now are aware of it?
I would say it's fundamentally because of the utility of the platform. Satellites are zipping around, and they're not able to be persistent for a period of time. There's also utility to being closer to the Earth, including for electronic intelligence collection. You know, there's speculation that perhaps what this Chinese balloon was doing was not really taking pictures, which you can do from space, but perhaps trying to gobble up some of our electronic communications, maybe cell phone communications or similar things near some sensitive military site. It's also, by the way, possible to have much heavier payload that is pretty expensive to put into orbit.
So, Tom, going back to the object shot out of the sky by the U.S. military, still a lot of confusion there. We know the first one was definitely a balloon. We know less about the other three objects. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre did say this on Monday.
There is no indication of aliens or extraterrestrial activity with these recent takedowns.
Yeah, well, the focus on ET seems a little glib considering the potential danger these objects pose. What do we know about these other objects the U.S. has taken out of the skies?
We don't yet know, according to Pentagon and White House spokespeople, exactly what some of these others were that were taken down. Hopefully we'll find out. I think what's changed in part is that we have changed how we are seeing these things. In the past, the sensors and the computers attached to the sensors for things like NORAD, that protects North America against aerial threats, they had filters on the data to basically say, give me a ping if the radars pick up something that's moving very fast and looks like a bomber. That was one reason that they weren't seeing, or at least the operators weren't seeing, what perhaps the radar energy was seeing, because the algorithms were standing in the way. They took those filters off, and all of a sudden, you see lots of other aerial phenomena being picked up, being engaged, and yes, being shot down. So this really points to the overall need to have greater domain awareness for the full spectrum of potential aerial threats.
Yeah, go a little deeper on that, Tom. What do Washington and the Pentagon need to do to be better protected from balloon operations, wherever they may be coming from?
I think you're probably going to see some congressional hearings digging into this. There's going to be some pontificating about, you know, why weren't we looking for these aerial threats? Everybody knows that drones of various stripes, including lighter-than-air drones, are out there and about. I'm optimistic from the Pentagon side, from NORAD, and from Capitol Hill, you're going to have more people looking up. I don't think you have to be too imaginative to put together, to connect some dots. It's not just about balloons. This is part of an industrial scale espionage undertaking that China has been doing for years now.
Tom Carrico is a senior fellow and missile defense project director at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Tom, thank you very much. This is fascinating.
Thank you.
Even before the whole spy balloon debacle, U.S.-China relations were not in a good place. Now they're even worse, and Taiwan is at the center of the standoff. Beijing sees the island as a breakaway province that must be reunited with the motherland. Now, the U.S. military is not obliged to defend Taiwan from invasion. Still, the U.S. armed forces are actively training to intervene on Taiwan's side if a war does break out. And as the world's Patrick Wynn tells us, rhetoric from Pentagon officials about China and Taiwan has some experts worried.
The U.S. military's top brass seems to think that China will invade Taiwan by 2027. This belief even has a name, the 2027 Davidson Window, named for Phil Davidson, a retired Navy admiral who's popularized the idea. Now, a four-star Air Force general is saying his gut tells him China will invade by 2025. As for the current U.S. Navy chief, Mike Gilday, here's his assessment from 3 months ago.
When we talk about the 2027 window, in my mind, that has to be a 2022 window or potentially a 2023 window.
China did not invade Taiwan last year, and many experts who study China's Communist Party don't put much stock in the 2027 timeline either.
I think this is just completely off base.
Ian Johnson is with the Council on Foreign Relations. He speaks Chinese and lived in China for decades. Until very recently, he said, it looked like the U.S. and China might be ready to dial back the tension.
I thought up until the spy balloon, the pendulum was swinging back ever so slightly.
But in recent congressional hearings, Pentagon officials are again pointing to 2027. It's based on a stated goal by China's military, the People's Liberation Army, to become fully modern by the PLA's 100th anniversary in 2027. Taiwan is a de facto sovereign state founded in 1949 by Chinese anti-communists. Beijing still sees the island as an integral part of China, and many Pentagon officials assume that as soon as China finishes modernizing its army, it will invade.
The problem in Washington is that when a military person says something, it gains this credence because people think, oh, well, they must really know something. They must have military intelligence that we don't know.
Ian Johnson says these military predictions about 2027 don't line up with political analysis of China's Communist Party or its leader, Xi Jinping. Invading Taiwan would be a huge gamble. And Johnson says Xi isn't much of a gambler.
He's more of a cautious person. He's ruthlessly built out his power base, but he's not somebody that makes crazy decisions on a whim.
Or because his army has a big anniversary coming up. Beijing has been threatening Taiwan more and more. 6 months ago, after U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited the island, China briefly surrounded it with fighter jets and warships.
China is increasingly bellicose, and the Chinese leadership is a bit of a black box.
But even inside the Pentagon, some generals say this speculation game is getting out of hand. Here's Air Force Chief of Staff Charles Brown speaking on Monday.
There's been speculation. That speculation is not necessarily helpful. I've been disappointed by some of the comments that have been made.
General Brown says an invasion is not destined to happen.
I don't see that conflict is imminent or inevitable, and the goal is to avoid it.
Predicting an adversary is gearing up for war might stoke a sense of urgency or help secure bigger military budgets, but it has its risks. Ian Johnson sees parallels to the dawn of World War I.
Each side assumed the other was mobilizing, and therefore they had to mobilize. And before you know it, Europe's marching to war without anybody really wanting that to happen.
The U.S. isn't bound by any treaty to fight China over Taiwan, though President Joe Biden has suggested twice that he would use force to protect the island. For now, more friction over Taiwan looks likely. Beijing has warned Taiwan's leaders not to let any more U.S. lawmakers visit the island. But there's a congressional delegation now discussing a trip for this spring. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
In Tokyo, affordable rental apartments are rare, and when you do find one, they are small. But given the high prices and scarcity, young people are willing to move into even smaller, and I'm talking tiny places, called shoebox apartments. From Tokyo, Tsanka Sirapala has our story.
Koenji is one of Tokyo's coolest central city neighborhoods. When you get off the train, you see young people everywhere carrying guitars and records. Last summer, 30-year-old Hanako Watanabe moved to this neighborhood from central Japan. Her search for affordable housing led her to a 95-square-foot one-room apartment. These compact micro-apartments are half the size of an average studio apartment in Tokyo. Watanabe welcomes me into her apartment. I take my shoes off and she offers me a fresh can of warm coffee purchased from a vending machine. The all-white interior doesn't hide the astonishingly small living space, but the 4-meter-high ceiling definitely helps create the feeling of more space. It also makes up for size with coziness. There's a warm-toned fluffy carpet and pillows that are also modern and stylish. It's packed with all the basics: a shower, a toilet, washing machine, small fridge, and microwave. I ask her if she ever feels claustrophobic. There is that kind of lingering feeling, she tells me. I've gotten used to it, but I do bump into things. Instead of displaying art, the walls serve as a place to store things. Her Louis Vuitton bag hangs among a dozen other fashionable bags. We sit down on the floor. It's comfortable even without the typical sofa or coffee table setup. On normal days, I bump into things quite a bit, she says. For example, when I go up the stairs to the loft, I use a ladder, and when I climb the ladder, I usually hit the clothes on the rack, or when I change my clothes, I hit the wall. But she chose this apartment because it's close to work and less expensive. The cleaning is quick and easy because of the small space. I'm also saving money since I try not to buy unnecessary things, and I always get rid of things I don't need. Although micro-apartments are popular among young people recently, architect Asby Brown says there's a long tradition of compact housing in Japan. Before the birth of modern Tokyo, it wasn't uncommon for families to live in 95 square feet.
And in that one room, everything was done convertibly. They could move things out of the way, portable furniture. They would pull things when they need them. They put the bedding out when they're sleeping. Then they put it away. They hang things on the wall. Very, very super compact living.
Hanako Watanabe's apartment is designed, built, and managed by Japanese real estate developer Spilitus. A newly built studio apartment in this area would normally set you back roughly $1,000 each month, on top of 1 month's deposit, a realtor fee, and a mandatory thank you payment to the landlord. But micro apartments are around 20% cheaper. Brown says property developers like Spilitus have found a sweet spot in the market.
Certainly New York, Paris, it's pretty expensive, right? And Tokyo is fairly reasonable compared to that. But this means a lot of people are living in these one-room apartments. On the positive side, you know, they have found a way to present this in an attractive way that a lot of people seem to want.
Since moving into a tiny apartment, Hanako Watanabe says the space has grown on her, though she's alone a lot. Home is where you make it. I feel like I've become more comfortable in the space I live in. I feel like I spend more time at home, she says. The biggest change is that I can no longer invite people over. Eventually, she hopes to move up in her career, get married, and move into a standalone home. For The World, I'm Tsanka Sirapala in Tokyo.
And you're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's been almost a year since Russia launched an all-out invasion of Ukraine. It's been hard to see how exactly this ends. If you ask Ukraine's leaders, victory will come when Russians are kicked out of all of Ukraine. That includes the Crimean Peninsula. This territory was illegally annexed by Russia in 2014. Some of the people most impacted by this have been Crimean Tatars. The Tatars are a Turkic ethnic group, predominantly Muslim, who have lived in Crimea for centuries. The World's Daniel Hoffman spoke with some of them in the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv.
Chiburiecki is the Crimean Tatar national dish. They're deep-fried turnovers filled with ground beef or lamb and onions, and they're a specialty here at Irfan Kudusov's restaurant. Kudusov is 54 years old, he's a father of four, and he's a Crimean Tatar activist. The walls of this place are covered in photographs, paintings, postcards. The restaurant feels a little like a museum. There's one striking painting with a stork confined in a golden cage. The cage is so tight that the bird can't even spread its wings, Kudusov says. That bird in the cage is like the Crimean Tatar people, he explains. Crimea is golden. It's a beautiful place, he says. But Crimean Tatars who live there are under Russian occupation, and they've lived like that for almost 9 years. In February 2014, Russian troops entered Crimea. Then Russia staged a referendum vote, and within a couple of weeks, Moscow made it official. Республики Крым и города Севастополь. At the Kremlin, President Vladimir Putin declared that Crimea is part of the Russian Federation. Nearly the entire international community said that the annexation was illegal. Samuel Cherup is a political scientist with the RAND Corporation think tank.
This was a major political boost for Putin, the annexation of Crimea, and I think Putin has come to view Crimea as an organic part of Russia as much as any other undisputed region. It has this additional strategic importance as the base of Russia's Black Sea Fleet.
Cherup says Crimea is a huge part of Putin's legacy and his current political standing. For the Ukrainians, it's simply Russian-occupied territory. Наша ціль – деокупувати всі наші території. Крим є нашою землею. Last month at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, President Volodymyr Zelensky said, Crimea is our land, our sea, and our mountains, and that Ukraine will liberate the region. Here's Samuel Cherup again.
Ukraine, under no circumstances, even before the war, would have been willing to cede its legal claim to the peninsula. I think the issue is what militarily makes sense for the Ukrainians. Whether retaking Crimea would be plausible, and even if plausible, worth the escalation risks.
So militarily, it's very difficult.
That's Jeffrey Edmonds. He's with the Center for Naval Analysis in Arlington, Virginia.
You know, there's a very tight choke point leading from mainland Ukraine into Crimea. It makes it easier to defend, and they would have to go by land. The Ukrainians really don't have much of an amphibious capability. They could certainly shell the peninsula if they got close enough, but it would be very hard militarily to take it.
Since the start of Russia's invasion last year, the U.S. has said it supports Ukraine's right to defend its territory. But when it comes to retaking Crimea by military force, things get a little more complicated.
There's the potential for tension if the administration felt that the escalatory risks were too high. The administration has clearly taken steps to feel its way through, you know, the escalation landscape and try not to cause unnecessary escalation. They would continue to assess that if the Ukrainians were in a position to take Crimea.
Hello. Hello. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
Emila Tasheva is a Ukrainian government official based in Kyiv. But her role is all about Crimea. She's President Zelensky's special representative for the territory.
I am Crimean Tatar. I am Ukrainian citizen. I born in Uzbekistan. When I 5 years old, I returned with my parents, with my grandmother to Crimea, where my parents even now live in Crimea in temporary occupied territory.
Thousands of Crimean Tatars have similar stories. In May 1944, as a result of Stalin's orders, tens of thousands of Crimean Tatars were deported from their native homeland. They were forcibly relocated to Soviet republics in Central Asia. In the process, thousands of Crimean Tatars died.
When Crimean Tatars is deported in 1944, all these Crimean Tatar people in countries of Central Asia, we fight to freedom and fight for returning to Crimea.
In the final years of the Soviet Union, many Crimean Tatars, including Tasheva's family, returned. She says that was a joyful time. but it was not without some difficulties.
It's not easy, of course, because they persecuted Crimean Tatars in the end of 18th and early 90s.
The government made it almost impossible for Crimean Tatars to reclaim lost property. Buying land and building new homes was also difficult. Still, tens of thousands of Crimean Tatars resettled in their homeland as the Soviet Union fell apart and Ukraine gained independence. Life back in Ukraine started feeling normal, but everything changed in 2014. Here's Tamila Tasheva again.
In 2014, it's really military operation of occupation of territory. And Crimean Tatars do not support Russia because of persecution. Crimean Tatars start to flee in Crimea, but most stay and live in Crimea.
Over the last year, Russia has intensified its crackdown on Crimean Tatar institutions and civil society. Tasheva says more than 150 Crimean Tatars are now locked up in Russian prisons.
Ukrainian state don't have access to Crimea, but of course we have a lot of communication and connection with our people. And of course we support our people. For us, very important to maintain some connections between Crimea and mainland of Ukraine.
Tasheva says she and her team are already planning for the eventual liberation of Crimea from Russian occupation.
I totally agree with my president. For Ukraine, victory is mean we liberate all our territories, including this Autonomous Republic of Crimea and city of Sevastopol.
Back at Irfan Kudusov's restaurant, he explains the irony of his life as a Crimean Tatar living in the Ukrainian capital.
У нас люди в оккупации живут, а мы здесь, да? Мы как бы на свободе, но не дома. Они дома, но не на свободе. Такой парадокс.
We have our freedom, but not our home, he tells me. While Crimean Tatars still in Crimea have their home, but they don't have freedom. Kudusov brings up the painting with the stork again, the bird trapped in a golden cage.
Это мне говорит опыт не только мой сегодняшний, да, человека, которому 54 года, а и опыт моего отца.
He says his family waited for decades to return to Crimea. And they did, back in the early 90s. And now, once more, he says he has no doubt that Crimean Tatars driven out by the Russian invasion will return as well. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman, Kyiv, Ukraine.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Coming up, we speak with Malala Yousafzai. She has a Nobel Peace Prize and now an Oscar-nominated documentary about a troubled man who set out to bomb a mosque in Indiana. Instead, he was won over by the same people he set out to kill.
What's at the center of this message is people opening their doors and their hearts to strangers.
That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The epicenter of the first earthquakes in Turkey was some 700 miles to the south of Istanbul, Turkey's largest city. People in Istanbul might not have felt the shaking, but they certainly felt the emotional impact and have mobilized to help people in the south of Turkey. They're gathering medicine, canned food, tents, blankets, any resources they can. From Istanbul, Fariba Nawa has more.
Young and old gather in nearly every neighborhood in Istanbul to give back. The Turkish government gave school and university students a two-week break after the February 6th massive earthquake so the buildings could become donation centers. Teenagers huddle together in front of the Turkish Red Crescent blood drive on the seaside in the freezing cold. 18-year-old student Esra Genç is giving blood for the first time. Our people are out there in difficult conditions, struggling with their lives, she says. We help them because at the end of the day, this could have happened to us too. Genç has relatives in Hatay, one of the hardest-hit cities near the border of Syria. When I heard what happened, it felt like my soul left my body, she says. Some of her relatives were pulled out from the concrete and rubble.
Halam var Adana'da, kuzenlerim, eniştelerim.
My other aunt, cousins, and brother-in-law are also in that area, she says, dealing with a similar situation. My aunt is in the hospital, and she also has heart problems. The grief is visible at these donation centers. People hug and shed quiet tears. There's a lot of cigarette smoking and somber faces. But mostly volunteers work, sifting through material, stuffing and taping boxes, sometimes for 12 hours straight. Many Turks are angry over the government's initial slow response to dig victims from under the rubble. The delay caused more deaths. They say people are stepping in where the government falls short. On the day of the earthquake, Genç Kumitaları, a political workers' rights organization, posted a call for donations on their social media. Demir Karabacak is a student at Bosphorus University and member of the group.
As an organization, we don't have lots of cards, like three of them, but we are just calling all of the people around Istanbul to tell them it's an emergency situation, so you have to send a car, and they are just helping. Because of the government's lack of help, we just have to take responsibility about it, and we are just taking it.
Turkish banks sent text messages to their clients to ignore calls for financial donations, unless it's coming from a trusted source. People still donate money, but showing up to volunteer is more gratifying, they say. At the Nazım Hikmet Cultural Center in Kadıköy, dozens of volunteers line up to pass boxes down a stairway until it reaches a lorry truck. The truck will drive through roads damaged by the earthquake for at least 12 hours to reach those in need. Once they arrive, more volunteers will unload and distribute the donations to survivors. Teacher Shaban Kızılkaya and her two teenagers, Denise and Elmas, already dropped off their donations.
We dropped off nappies, sanitary towels, toilet paper, biscuits, and pasta. We dropped it off at my daughter's high school. They were having a collection there.
Today, they came to the Nazım Hikmet Center to volunteer. But organizers told them they don't need any more people. At Marmara University, students say they need supplies more than volunteers, especially medicine. They accept medication from anyone. But healthcare workers like Mustafa Khan Aktepe make sure the meds are safe.
We only use ambulance or airplanes. And we send them with healthcare professionals because they need to be given by a healthcare professional and taken by a healthcare professional.
The government announced last week that universities across Turkey will be online for the rest of the school year. Dormitories are being used to house homeless survivors of the earthquake. Many students are upset that they're being kicked out of their dorms and classrooms. But Aktepe, also a physiotherapy student at Marmara, says it's time for generosity, not critique.
If I talk for myself, I'm a healthcare professional, and right now my only priority is to save those people, help those people. So it's not the right time for political matters or asking about who did the right thing, who did the wrong thing. It's time to ask how can we help more.
Others say you can criticize corruption and neglect in the government and still support the victims of the earthquake. But everyone is in agreement that being there for the survivors is the priority. For The World, I'm Fariba Nawa in Istanbul.
A surprise resignation in Scotland. The country's leader, Nicola Sturgeon, spoke earlier today.
I have believed that part of serving well would be to know, almost instinctively, when the time is right to make way for someone else. In my head and in my heart, I know that time is now.
Sturgeon is Scotland's first female First Minister. She's the person to hold the post the longest, on the job for 8 years. Nicola Sturgeon has also been a relentless advocate for Scottish independence. Laura Webster is the editor of The National in Scotland. She's speaking to us from Glasgow. How big of a surprise was this resignation, Laura?
I think realistically, it wasn't a major surprise. The timing was insane. We weren't expecting it this morning, but it seemed reasonable that it could be happening in the coming months. There have been major splits within her party on how to pursue Scottish independence after the Supreme Court's decision that we require Westminster's permission to actually hold a referendum. And she hasn't been able to bring everybody together and build a consensus. And so I think it makes sense that she, as leader of the biggest pro-independence party, would feel it is her time to step down.
Well, Sturgeon didn't get independence across the finish line, but she has been leading Scotland for 8 years. What has she been able to accomplish?
People, I think, will remember her most for leading Scotland during the COVID pandemic. There was a real feeling that Boris Johnson's government was reckless and not taking the situation seriously enough. And Nicola could not have been more different from that. She was on TV pretty much every day doing COVID briefings, keeping everybody in the know about what was going on in the hospitals, how many people were dying, updating people on the vaccination progress. I think she genuinely made people feel quite safe and reminded people what Scotland can do for itself. We are not reliant on the Union and Westminster. So I think that that really was why her approval ratings grew so much during 2020 and 2021. And since we've come out of that pandemic era, they have gone back roughly to where they were beforehand.
But to the issue of Scottish independence, Nicola Sturgeon has really been the face of that movement for some time now. How did she take on that role?
So she became First Minister in 2014. That was after Scotland voted no at the independence referendum of September, and obviously led the SNP into the general election of 2015, where the SNP took 56 of Scotland's 59 seats, which is a really incredible win. And then in 2016, Brexit happened. Now, Brexit really changed everything. Scotland voted 62% to remain in the EU, while the rest of the UK voted to leave the EU. So there was a massive row over that, where people in Scotland felt they were being forced out of the EU. They felt very connected to the EU. We feel that we're a European country. And so that really gave the SNP and Nicola Sturgeon an opportunity to start promoting the idea of independence again. And they did that very successfully.
So Laura, you mentioned earlier that splits in the political arena were kind of the preamble to Sturgeon's resignation announcement. Some observers are saying her undoing was a controversial gender identity bill. Tell us about that and how it did affect her.
So the Gender Recognition Reform Bill makes it easier for people to legally change their gender, to change their birth certificate, and it makes sure that when they get married, their correct gender is written on their marriage certificate, and when they die, their correct gender is written on their death certificate. It really isn't this major controversial legislation, or at least it shouldn't be, but it has become that. It has become part of this culture war. And in the last few weeks, there was a whole other row linked to the issue of transgender prisoners. And it did seem to be a big problem for Nicola Sturgeon in that she was being asked about it constantly. But truthfully, I really don't feel that the Gender Recognition Reform Bill is the thing that has pushed her over the edge. She has been First Minister for over 8 years. Nobody can lead a country forever. There's always going to be an expiration date.
There has been an inevitable comparison, inevitable perhaps, between Nicola Sturgeon's decision to step down and that of Jacinda Ardern, the Prime Minister of New Zealand. Both are women. Both resignations took their countries sort of by surprise. Aside from that, is the comparison fair?
To be honest, I think the only place the comparison really exists is that they are both women and both political leaders. I think a lot of the right wing here in the UK are really keen to portray Nicola as a Jacinda Ardern wannabe, whereas their politics are fairly different. And I don't really see the connection other than them both being fantastic, strong female leaders, of course.
Laura Webster is the editor of The National in Scotland, speaking with us from Glasgow. Laura, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Japan is changing its policy around nuclear power. Last Friday, the cabinet agreed to allow nuclear reactors to be operated beyond their current 60-year limit. The policy also calls for new reactors to replace aging ones. This is all about reducing carbon emissions. But when you mention nuclear power and Japan in the same sentence, what comes to mind, of course, is the 2011 Fukushima nuclear plant disaster. For a reality check on this news, we reached out to Tobias Harris. He's deputy director of the Asia program at the German Marshall Fund and joins us from Washington. Tobias, Japan's Prime Minister Fumio Kishida approved this new policy on Friday. How have Japan's nuclear regulators responded?
Well, this was actually in coordination with Japan's nuclear regulators, and that really is the reality of this nuclear energy policy shift. There's been a change in public opinion, but the public is more open to the idea. But I think there's a sense that if this was done without the cooperation of nuclear regulators, that public opinion would sour very quickly.
Give us a reality check on Japan, Tobias. Who and what does the country depend on for its energy needs?
Well, you know, it's sort of the standard story of Japan. you know, that they're resource poor, that they've been heavily dependent on fossil fuels imported from the Middle East, to some extent also from Russia, natural gas from Southeast Asia, as well as the Middle East, and increasingly the United States. And so they import all of their fossil fuels. They are very conscious of this. And nuclear energy certainly gave them an option for at least some energy security, that, you know, this was an indigenous power source, although, of course, their nuclear fuel cycle was not entirely indigenous, but something that they could, you know, have a dependable source of power at home. And, of course, that is part after the war in Ukraine revealed the risks of overseas energy dependence has, I think, contributed to the push to restart reactors.
Mm. And given that energy dependence on other places and sources of fuel, I'm curious, what percentage in Japan is nuclear right now?
That's the thing, though. So there's been a gradual process of restarting nuclear reactors that were taken offline after that 2011 disaster. And there's been at least a written goal of getting to something around 20 or 22% of Japan's energy electricity generation from nuclear for a number of years now. But because of the regulatory process, they've gotten nowhere near that. The fact is, I mean, if they've reached 10%, that would be a lot. It is a small share of their electricity generation right now.
Mm. I'm curious, what was the percentage of nuclear power in Japan before the Fukushima disaster in 2011?
So in 2011, Japan was getting approximately 30% of its electricity from nuclear and was really planning on extending that and growing that over the following decade. But obviously, that's not what happened.
That's extraordinary. I mean, there was a real drawdown then after that disaster.
Yes, that's correct.
I mean, there was a lot of alarm over nuclear right after that 2011 earthquake, tsunami, then that crashed into the Fukushima nuclear plant, setting off several meltdowns. What safeguards were put in place after that disaster?
So you had the creation of an entirely new regulator that was really going to take a close look at every reactor in the country for its safety, its seismic risks, certainly scrutinizing types of reactors in particular that were similar to the ones that melted down at the Fukushima Daiichi plant. Basically, there's been a process where they turned them all off and then having this extensive review process before approving their restart. And that also is not just a regulatory process, it's also a political process, because even if the regulators approve that, you have to get the local governments and the prefectural governments to agree to turning them on. Mm. So there's been a lot of deference to public opinion, to local public opinion, sort of acknowledging that this cannot be rushed through, that you have to assure that the public is confident in the review that the regulators have conducted.
So this is about diversifying, really, Japan's energy mix. Is this new plan all about cutting carbon emissions? And isn't that a relatively new argument for nuclear power?
That's absolutely right. In fact, you know, in the past, it was much more about energy security. It was much more, you know, energy independence. Now, I think you've seen in the last 2 years or so, basically ever since the Japanese government adopted a 2050 zero emissions target, that it's become much more common for proponents of nuclear energy to make a decarbonization case for nuclear energy, much, much more than one ever heard in the past.
I mean, if that's how the government in Japan is making its pitch, do you think it will work to convince the nuclear antagonists and skeptics?
It's hard to say, because, you know, the opposition, I mean, justifiably, I mean, you know, 2011 was a really frightening event for not just, of course, within Japan, I mean, ramifications for nuclear power around the globe. And the opponents of nuclear energy, I think, just, you know, don't entirely trust the process. They don't entirely trust the politicians. I don't think they're convinced entirely by the regulatory process. So that opposition is, I think, resistant to some of the arguments and certainly to the people making the arguments in favor of nuclear power. But that said, it does seem, certainly looking at opinion polls on the whole, that the public in general is starting to shift, that you are seeing people respond, whether it's from an environmental perspective or just bringing energy costs down. The public might be starting to shift, but I think it's still a vulnerable shift, and the government has to be very careful about how it proceeds here.
Tobias Harris with the German Marshall Fund, speaking with us about Japan's plan to go big on nuclear again, one small step at a time. Tobias, thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi was on the phone with President Biden yesterday. White House spokesperson Karine Jean-Pierre briefed reporters about the call.
They discussed the historic agreement for Air India to purchase over 200 American-made aircraft from Boeing. President Biden noted how the sale will support over 1 million American jobs across 44 states.
And that was just the warm-up act. Modi also made a call yesterday to France to order some planes from Airbus. That was broadcast live on Indian TV.
Your Excellency, my friend, President Emmanuel Macron,
The French president waited on camera for a full 7 minutes for his turn to respond.
Thank you very much for offering us the opportunity to celebrate this strategic partnership in the aerospace sector.
In India, the story is huge.
Big breaking news coming in here in India today. Air India, now owned by the Tata Group, has just announced a mega acquisition of...
Mega? You can say that again. The Times of India reported the combined deals will cost Air India $80 billion. 250 new planes from Airbus, 220 from Boeing, for a total of 470 adds to its fleet, plus jet engines from Britain's Rolls-Royce and General Electric in the U.S. It gives India's biggest airline the chance to compete head-to-head with flashy international carriers like Qatar Airways, Singapore Airlines, and Emirates. If Air India plays its cards right, it too might get a chance, like Emirates did recently, to license a song by Frank Sinatra.
Come fly with me, let's fly away.
You're listening to The World.
If you can use some exotic food.
At the Oscars next month, the nominees for documentaries all tell stories that, as is often the case, are often more finely chiseled than the feature films. One documentary short titled Stranger at the Gate is about a former U.S. Marine who suffers from PTSD, who sets out to bomb a mosque in Muncie, Indiana.
My plan was to detonate an IED right outside the Muncie Islamic Center on a Friday afternoon when they were all gathered, and I was hoping for at least 200 or more.
There is a lot more to this incredible story. The executive producer of Stranger at the Gate brings her own well-known personal experience to the project. She also had a confrontation with a soldier consumed with hate, bent on assassination. I'm speaking of Nobel Peace Prize winner Malala Yousafzai. She joins us to talk about Stranger at the Gate and her other projects. Malala Yousafzai, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Marco.
It's been about 11 years since you were riding on that bus in rural Pakistan when a Taliban gunman shot you in the head. The reason? You'd been speaking out for education for young women. Now you're taking on projects like this film. Tell us about the main character in Stranger at the Gate, former Marine Richard Mack McKinney. Who is he?
Mack has gone through a tough time in his life. He has seen conflicts and wars, and he is very protective of his family and his daughter especially. And he also listens to media where he thinks that Muslims are a threat to his family and to the community. And he makes the decision to completely erase Muslims. And his first target is the Islamic Center in his own town. And that's where the story begins.
How did his story, how did Mack's story resonate with you and your own experiences growing up in Pakistan?
The gunmen who shot me were told that I was not belonging to Islam or to their culture, that I was somebody alien to them. And I think that's where hatred and division begins. You know, these are the things we need to address, because when you connect with people from different backgrounds, from different cultures, faiths, you realize that there is shared humanity between all of you. So these divisions and this hatred that emerges can really lead to worse consequences. The gunman who was told all of that decided to attack me. I survived that attempt. And the same thing happened in Mack's life as well, where he decided to attack hundreds of people, Muslim people. But it changed. And I think there is something powerful that changed that. And that is love, that is kindness, that is compassion. And I'm glad that Mack had the willingness to welcome that love, to be able to actually experience that. And on the other hand, I'm just so happy that the people who he wanted to attack, Bibi, her family and others, they actually were so kind and compassionate that even after knowing that Mack had planned all of this, they decided to invite him over for dinner and have a conversation with him.
Yeah, I mean, that love is so powerful, and we're about to hear that. The story of former Marine Mack McKinney, he shows up at this Muncie, Indiana mosque unannounced, and he's there on a sort of reconnaissance mission for his bombing plot. There are some worshipers who remember when he came in, he looked agitated and troubled, and he starts meeting people, including a local family physician, Sabir Bahrami, who is the husband of Bibi Bahrami, whom you just mentioned. Here's Dr. Bahrami talking about what he was feeling when he met McKinney.
My first impression of McKinney was he seemed to be like a redneck. But he came to the masjid, and he's like a guest also. So I couldn't help it except to hug him and make him feel, not artificially, from my heart, that he is welcome and he is part of us.
Mm. Malala, one thing that struck me about this former Marine and would-be assassin is how firmly he thought his plot was the right thing to do. How do you make sense of that?
These things don't make sense. Hatred, divisions don't make sense, and we need to challenge that. And I am just in awe of the steps that Bibi and her family took, because there is something really powerful about following our virtues. And it's not just about talking about being courageous and compassionate. It's just about putting them into practice, and that's what they did. And for me, when I think about these values, it gives me hope for a better future for the world.
So you're saying it's the same kind of courage, but one needs to kind of turn that inside out, love facing first.
It's important that we talk about these values and these issues, but also make sure that we practice them as well. When I think about kindness, compassion, forgiveness, I think about it in my day-to-day life and how I follow it as a person, how I treat family members, my friends, strangers, and, you know, what is my role in my day-to-day life, but also on social media and other platforms as well. And just not end the conversation there, but to begin a new conversation about what role we can play in really challenging the stereotypes that exist, in the divisions and hatreds that have been created. So I think it gives me hope that we will be able to start a new conversation about how do we bring more hope for humanity.
In the end, the film Stranger at the Gate is, as you've already underscored, it's about the power of a kind act. Here's one of the women at the mosque, Bibi Bahrami, whom you've mentioned, and former Marine, Richard Mack McKinney.
I comforted him. I gave him the attention. I think that's the basic memory that I have. Not only just with Mac, I would do this with any guest.
These people were just plain old pleasant. Happy to be alive. Happy to be in America. Just happy. And more than happy to talk to me.
Is there a thread or an act of kindness that ties your personal experience in Pakistan to this documentary that takes place in Muncie, Indiana?
During my time in Swat Valley, when we faced conflict, we were also internally displaced. And for 3 months, it was the people of other cities, other towns who welcomed us. So what's at the center of this message is people opening their doors and their hearts to strangers, to others, that can give us a spark of hope for a better future for everyone.
That's Nobel Peace Prize laureate and activist Malala Yousafzai. She's the executive producer of the Oscar-nominated documentary Stranger at the Gate. Tomorrow, in part two of our conversation, Malala Yousafzai talks about options for young women fighting repression in Afghanistan and efforts to bolster democracy in her own country of Pakistan. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you again right here tomorrow.
We were blown away by the support we received during our 2022 fundraiser. Over 668 listeners made donations to support The World. Here are just a few of those supporters. Robert Briggs, John Duke, J. Lois Diamond, Leslie Anderson, Robert Hill, Jasmina Nielsen, R.P. Marlin Curiel, Carol Boschka, David Watt, Leonardo Chimiri. While we weren't able to individually thank each person who donated, know that here at The World, we are forever grateful for every single person who listens to and supports the show. From PRX.